Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Main Street. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. Later in today's show, Rick Guillon joins me. Rick and I will dive into the flavors of local Mexican restaurants, sure to get your taste buds a-tingling. Plus, our longtime friend, Dr. Tom Easern, is back with a new Plains Folk essay. This week, Tom shares a North Dakota whodunit, a tale from McIntosh County. But first, we're excited to welcome Adora Land, the grant-making director for the Bush Foundation. Adora will explain why this year will be a great time for North Dakotans to apply for Bush Foundation grants or fellowships, especially with new and increased funding opportunities. And it's my pleasure to welcome Adora Land, the grant-making director for the Bush Foundation, to Main Street. Adora, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
I want to begin by giving our listeners an overview of the Bush Foundation and its mission, and maybe a little bit of its history.
So the Bush Foundation, we are a place-based foundation that invests in great ideas and the people that power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. We're really interested in the creative solutions generated by communities that we serve. So we don't have a specific issue priority. However, we are looking for the most innovative things that are going on within our in our region. In addition to that, we have grants that come directly from us, and we fund partners, we fund efforts, and so that really align and support the great ideas and the people that power them.
So when you say ideas, when you say projects, when you say things that are just really helpful for the area, give us an overview of what that means. There may be some people listening that have a great idea, but aren't sure if it kind of fits with what the Bush Foundation wants to accomplish.
So we're really just looking to hear from different people in communities about what they are doing in their area and how they need support in order to make it even grander. So we're not an organization that, like I said, doesn't go for a specific issue, but we're looking for what is the innovation that is having it, that you have? How are you testing your ideas, spreading your ideas? And not only in the spaces that you're in, but how can you share that across the region? And so that's the type of innovation that we're really looking for.
Are you hoping to reach out to nonprofits, to individuals, to both? And I know that you really have a goal of enhancing and increasing the applicants from North Dakota who can take advantage of what the Bush Foundation has to offer.
As a foundation, it's both, right? It's nonprofits, it's individuals, sometimes it's businesses, sometimes it's educational institutions in cities. And so we're really open to what we can support as an organization. And of course, the people part is not just the people in the Bush Fellowship, but we also want to support the people who are doing the work for the innovative ideas that they're also powering.
Who is the Bush in Bush Foundation?
So Archibald Bush is a native of Granite Falls, Minnesota. I'm someone that made a career in bookkeeping for small companies based in Duluth, Minnesota, and at some point worked for the company that is now called 3M. And so Archibald was really committed to building leaders and started programming where he would send different leaders to Harvard as an opportunity to develop themselves. And that's still some of the work that we're doing today.
So primarily in the past, there have been folks from Minnesota, from South Dakota, from North Dakota that applied. But again, back to the question, why is it so important for North Dakotans to get involved in this program?
I mean, as an organization that is supporting the across the region, we want to see a good balance of the region and support a good balance of our region across the board. And so we want to see more fellows coming from North Dakota, because we know that there are great ideas that are happening in North Dakota. There are great people that are leading things in North Dakota that may feel even a little intimidated by applying for the Bush Fellowship, but we want to see them do the work on a grander scale and be even recognized for the work that they're doing.
What does it take to apply for a Bush Foundation Fellowship or a Bush Foundation grant, and what are the timetables?
So this year, we have some really exciting things that are happening with the Bush Fellowship. We are providing more money, we're recognizing more fellows, and we're having an application process that has fewer questions. So when I say more money, that means that we have changed our fellowship amount from $100,000 to $150,000. We've increased our number of fellows from 24 fellows to 30. And now our application is just one application process with 5 questions. And so these changes were really important for us as we talked to Bush Fellow alumni and community members around the region in order to be able to max out the flexibility in the program that the Bush Fellowship actually allows.
What's the responsibility of a Bush Fellow once she is given the grant or once their organization is given the grant?
So in the Bush Fellowship, we are specifically granting individuals and not organizations, but the responsibility is really for them after they filled out the application and talked about what is their vision for their community, what is their vision for themselves, how do they see themselves in the work, as well as what are the action steps that they take to get there. The responsibility is for them to take those action steps. We want to be a supporter for them in doing the work that they're doing. So they are sharing their stories with us, and we are looking for them to really live out the plan that they have determined for themselves. That is actually one of the most unique things about the fellowship. It's very flexible. And so people have the opportunity to think about all the ways that they want to learn and develop themselves as a leader, outside of some of the traditional ways of learning. So they get to choose for themselves. We don't choose that for them. And I think that is one of the most exciting things about the Bush Fellowship.
I have a job at XYZ company that I work at now, but I have this great idea, but I'm not an accountant or anything like that. How am I ever going to manage the Bush Foundation grant? What would you tell me in that scenario?
We often tell people, like, you manage it, right? Like, just like you manage all the funds that you get within your job, this is something that we give to you, and you are creating a budget for yourself. You're creating a budget for your travel. You're sharing back what that budget looks like. So when you think about $150,000, I often tell people, what would you do? Like, how would you learn? And to think outside of the box. And so it is the responsibility of the individual to manage the money, but you also are the person who is coming up with the budget and saying, this is how I want to spend the money.
$150,000. It's been announced I've won a Bush Fellowship. How long do I have to expend those funds?
So the Bush Fellowship is up to 2 years. So once you're selected as a fellow, you have up to 2 years from that point in order to use your funds. And so you can decide to have a quicker plan than that. But what we recommend and what we see often is people who are going throughout the journey and needing the 2 years to actually fully fulfill the vision that they have for themselves with that grant amount.
Can that money be used to reimburse myself to live during that time that I'm trying to execute what I want to try to do with the Bush money?
Yes, it can. So we know that in the leadership journey, sometimes stepping away from all the work that you are currently doing is something that is needed in order for you to achieve the leadership development growth that you want to do. And so as fellows are thinking about their plans, we often ask them, do they need to step away from work? And if they do need to step away from work, they can utilize some of that grant to pay for some of their living expenses. Of course, we're not going to say use 100% of it to pay your living expenses, but we do want to make sure that we are making this process as easy on you as possible so that you can actually achieve the action items, the goals, and the plan that you set out for yourself.
I don't have a college education. I'm competing against people I know that do. Geez, I don't know. What's your message to someone like that?
So when we think about the Bush Fellowship, we're not necessarily looking at an education that someone has or a role that someone has. We are looking for someone who really has a vision for the community that they have, a vision for how they want to grow themselves. And so there are some fellows that come in and say, I actually want to go and get a bachelor's degree. And that is something that we can select because we can see how this can further them and launch their career in a different way if they didn't have the Bush Fellowship. And so that is an opportunity that exists. We're not looking for a specific role. We're not looking for a specific title, but what we are really looking for is people who can lead and drive change across our region.
How does the Bush Foundation work with Native nations that are in the region?
So we center all of our work within North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, as well as the 23 Native Nations that share that geography. And so we're also doing outreach within those communities. We're also learning from those communities. And so they are also a big part of the work that is happening within the foundation, as well as on the fellowship.
How do you know that you're making a difference? How do you evaluate yourself to know that we're doing things the right way?
We have many conversations with people in our community, many conversations with people who have interactions with us. And we are always looking for the feedback of like, what is needed? How can we support our grantees and our fellows in an even greater way? I think one thing is that we always are trying to be very flexible and open. And we always say that we are, you know, we're radically open. So we have opportunities where people can just call us up and ask us questions. That doesn't happen in every foundation, but we have an opportunity every day of the week for people to contact us through our contact hub and just ask questions about the process, ask questions about their idea, and get a little bit of feedback from individuals who are staffing that line to say, like, let's go forth and be great. How can I support you? And so that is something that I think makes us unique as a foundation.
Enjoying our conversation with Adora Land. She is the grant-making director of the Bush Foundation. Adora, how would you tell me that you plan to evolve in the coming years? What's on your hope list, your wish list?
So this is a year with big evolutions, right? Like, we are increasing the grant. As I mentioned before, we're adding more fellows. We're having a simpler application process. And in the future, we are also going to be creating and posting a workbook where people can look at a tool that will allow them to reflect on their leadership, whether they're applying for the Bush Fellowship or not. One of the feedback that we hear often from the fellowship is that even when people don't get the Bush Fellowship, they are actually transformed by just applying, because it gives them an opportunity to reflect and think about things that they haven't necessarily thought about before. And so we are creating a workbook that will be launching this year in the fall, where people can start to look at their leadership journey, start to reflect and be able to share the story that may be difficult in sometimes when you are just coming into the Bush Fellowship application. You may not have ever had an opportunity to reflect on your leadership. You may not have ever had an opportunity to really write or share your story. This is the opportunity to start thinking and reflecting about that. Again, whether or not you choose to apply for the fellowship, we want you to really understand your own unique leadership story. And then also, I think on the back end, we are looking at different ways to connect Bush Fellows together. Because although this is not a cohort model where we're doing sessions together, it's a very individual, flexible program. We also know that this is a unique community, and that when they come together and that they do and they begin to work together, that even more change, radical change is happening across our region. And so we want to be able to create more opportunities to get connected as fellows, and for people who are even thinking about the fellowship to get more connected with Bush Fellows as well.
Adora, you are young. I'm old. You are a woman of color. I am a male Caucasian. Is the Bush Foundation Fellowship grant for both of us?
It's for both of us. It is for anyone who is really thinking radically about the work that they want to do and how they can better themselves. People always ask me, what is the secret? And I tell them the secret is you. We are looking for people who really have a strong vision for themselves and they know what they want to do to get there. And so anyone who has that, who lives in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, or the 23 Native Nations that live in that geography, this fellowship is for you.
Can you give us an idea of how long it generally takes someone from thinking that they want to apply to applying and then learning that they are becoming a Bush Fellow?
So Bush Foundation Fellowship applications are opening on September 17th, and then they close on October 15th at 12 p.m. So they will be available online, and you can contact us on our contact hub. If you have any questions, we'll be hosting office hours every day. And then you will find out if you've been selected to be a Bush Fellow around April. And this year, we were able to publicly announce those fellows in June. So it even for some people feels like an even longer time because they kept a secret from so many people for so long. But I think it's really well worth the wait in order for us to have this really intense, challenging process for the fellowship.
I have received some funds from other groups for my idea, but I would also like to have the support of the Bush Fellowship group. Can I have multiple, I guess, sources of support for my great idea?
You absolutely can have multiple sources. And that's something that I think that we support. We don't want to be the sole person that is supporting you in an idea. Of course, in the fellowship, if you have other things that are happening, we also want to support that. But essentially in the fellowship, we are supporting you. We're not supporting the idea specifically in the Bush Fellowship, but we are really supporting you and your individual growth as a leader. And I think that's one of the misconceptions about the fellowship, is that you think that you're supposed to come into the fellowship with a project. And we're not looking for you to have a project. We're not looking for you to say, this is what I want to fund in my community. But we are looking for you to say, this is how you can fund me in order for me to be an even more extraordinary leader than what I already am today.
How would you tell me, Adora, that the Bush Foundation differs from other grant-making organizations? You've talked a little bit about it, about being available, being able to respond and support. Are there other ways that the foundation really stands out, if you will?
I mean, I think those are great reasons, and also the flexibility. I think in everything that we do, we are looking to see what is working best for the people, the grantees, the fellows that we are working with. So we don't necessarily always have stringent guidelines around everything that we do, but we want to support people in the ways that work best for them. So even in the fellowship, as you said, it's $150,000. Who's going to maintain that money? Who's going to budget it for us? We're saying, here are some resources that you may be able to use in order to help you manage it, but we're not going to manage it for you, because this is the confidence that we have in you and your ability to lead.
Where can I find more information, and where can I find maybe examples of how other people have used Bush Foundation support to further advocate their projects or their ideas?
That's a great question. So all of, in that sense of being just radically different, all of this information is already on our website. So if you're thinking about applying for the Bush Fellowship, the questions are on the website. The criteria is on the website. You have the opportunity to read learning logs from Bush Fellows who are sharing their experiences throughout their journey, and an opportunity to look at our database of fellows that goes back over, I think, about 40, 50 years of fellows that we have had. And so you have an opportunity to read some of their stories directly from them, as well as just the short description of what they wanted to focus on in the fellowship. There's also a great opportunity to say, you know, for me to say, you know, sign up for our newsletter. Like, we are always sharing details about the webinars that we are going to be doing. That's another resource. We do webinars about the Bush Fellowship when the season comes. And so we're around the time as the applications open, you'll be seeing webinars pop up about the Bush Fellowship. But sign up for our newsletter, because anything that you want to know about the Bush Foundation will be in that newsletter.
Adora, give us your last best pitch on why North Dakotans should really think about pursuing a Bush Foundation fellowship.
North Dakotans really should think about pursuing a Bush Fellowship, because there is so much brilliance that is happening within your communities, and we want to be a supporter of that. And so as you think about the work that you are doing, as you are thinking about the innovation that you are bringing to your community, I don't want you to think about how there are other people who have higher titles and higher roles that are also doing the work, but how you could really advance your skills in order to take it to another level that maybe you haven't even dreamed of yet. So this is your opportunity to really think grand, think big about what your ideas are, how you want to accomplish that. And if you have already started that, the Bush Fellowship is for you.
The grant opportunities are up to $150,000. The grant process opens in September, and the website address is what, Adora?
It is bushfoundation.org.
Adora Land. She is the grant-making director for the Bush Foundation. Adora, it's a pleasure. Best wishes.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Discover the entertainment value of taking the train.
Trains are traveling talk shows.
Make new friends when you visit Sicily.
We made each other's acquaintance, and that's the beauty of it all.
And share the experience at a hot springs getaway.
There are some places that have a lot of pride in the way that hot springs can be an equalizer.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Dr. Tom Ezern is next with another of his Plains Folk essays. Tom shares a North Dakota whodunit, a gripping tale from McIntosh County involving a disputed paycheck, forgery accusations, and a deathbed confession.
Threshing time in McIntosh County, 1926, and the thresher man, Gottlieb Bundewald, was in the field. A young bundle pitcher, a neighbor from just a mile away, 16 years old, Christian Lux, hailed the thresher men to collect wages for work he had done, and things went badly from there. Witnesses disagreed what was said and done, and the parties disputed vehemently. This narrative comes to me from Shirley Fisher Aaron's masterly work, The Central Dakota Germans, Their History, Language, and Culture. Aaron's recounts an interview with a woman in Ashley who told the story of a deathbed confession. It seems one farmer sued another in a dispute about threshing and prevailed. The losing party appealed to the state Supreme Court, but lost there, too. The two parties remained at odds for 3 years until the plaintiff party lay dying. In the presence of his pastor and his antagonist, he confessed to having falsified evidence. All was forgiven. And for the first time in 3 years, the pastor administered Holy Communion to the old enemies. Gottlieb Bundewald was one of these parties. The other was not young Christian Lux, but rather his father, Jakob Lux, who died in 1932. With benefit of additional documentation, here is their story. Christian Lux had done some work for Bundewald at the agreed rate of $3 a day. When he came to collect, Bundewald said, well, he had worked a day and a quarter and gave him a check for $4. Young Lux said he had worked 2 3/4 days and was due $8 and a quarter. Between then and the time the check was cashed, someone altered the numerical amount on it to $8. The written amount, $4, however, still appeared. The bank cashed the check for $8. When it cleared, Bundewald was incensed. He talked with the old man, Jakob Lutz, but to no avail. So he took the matter to the state's attorney for McIntosh County, asked him to help get his money back. The attorney investigated, told Bundewald that he could not help with the civil action, but there might be a criminal case, and drew up a complaint against Christian Lutz for felony forgery. Bundewald took this to a justice of the peace, swore the complaint. Christian Lutz was arrested, charged, freed on bond. A jury trial ensued at the great Beaux-Arts McIntosh County Courthouse, at which most facts were agreed upon, although interpreters were involved. The key point of disagreement was who had altered the check. Bundewald said Christian Lux did it. Lux said Bundewald did it, at his insistence, in the field. The jury believed Lux and found him not guilty. Or possibly the members simply declined to convict the kid in what appeared to have been a spite case. It was well known and shown at trial. There was long-standing bad blood between the two neighbor families. Lux turned around and filed a $10,000 civil suit against Bundewald for malicious prosecution. The jury awarded him $1,000. Bundewald appealed to the state Supreme Court, which upheld the judgment. So things stood until that deathbed confession in 1932. I think I know what happened, based on how family economics worked in those days. Neither Gottlieb Bundewald nor Christian Lux altered the check. Young Lux took the check back home to his father, who fixed it and took it to the bank. I will say further, the state's attorney had no business facilitating charges in the case. The bank had no business cashing the check, and the pastor should have settled the matter long before it got to the deathbed. Those were human mistakes. In her book, though, Shirley Fisher Aarons makes much of the importance of community among the Germans from Russia. It was the old men, Lux and Bundewald, who violated that fundamental value. It was a good thing they both got absolution.
That was our great friend, Dr. Tom Ezern, a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Tom contributes his Plainsfolk essays each week here on Main Street. Rick Yeon joins us next with his weekly Prairie Plates. He's talking Mexican food this week. That's after this.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All right, eat pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Apple sauce and some nice red beets.
Happy Wednesday, Rick.
Happy Wednesday to you, Craig.
Rick Yeon joins us each and every Wednesday here on Main Street with a new edition of Prairie Plates, and this one's right in my wheelhouse, I would say. Rick, I enjoy Mexican food, and that's what we are going to talk about today. And you make a note, there really are a large number of restaurants in the area.
Yeah, and you're not alone, Craig. There are a lot of Mexican restaurants in the Fargo-Moorhead area, in the Bismarck-Mandan area, in the Grand Forks area, Minot, Dickinson, all over the state, all over the Prairie region. So yes, you're not alone. People really like Mexican food. They're there for a reason.
I mean, generally speaking, what we love about it is the variety that you can get at a Mexican restaurant. Generally, everything that you could possibly dream about is available and available quickly, it seems.
It is. The service at these restaurants is usually impeccable, and the prices are so low. Folks should really think about tipping them more than 20% because they really move and groove at these restaurants, and the food is high quality. It's quite good. I spent a lot of time, and during COVID, I was stuck down there in the Hill Country of Texas and ate a lot of good, like, Tex-Mex food down there, and it's comparable up here. The one thing is they don't really make a lot of fresh tortillas here, but some restaurants do, and I think that's just kind of an added bonus.
You make an interesting point about tipping, and I think it's one worth kind of emphasizing just a little bit. If something costs much less at one place, but your service is really great, I think that what you say is correct, Rick. Think about a little more than 20%, perhaps.
Yeah, and servers' minimum wage here in North Dakota is not very high, so keep that in mind. I'm not sure exactly where it's at these days, but it's not where... It's not exactly high. Let's just put it that way. And so, yeah, these folks are dependent on tips, and they have families and expenses just like everyone else. And so I think that, yes, if prices are low and service is high, I definitely like to give them a little bonus.
Rick, there aren't just Mexican restaurants around. There are Mexican food trucks around, and quite a few of them.
Yeah, in Fargo-Moorhead here, there are quite a few. I would say 5 or 6, maybe more. There's actually one that goes by no name that's just a white food truck that says tacos on it, and people love it. They rave about it, and there's like a watermelon drink that they do, and they're usually over at Burlington Coat Factory on 13th Avenue in Fargo, and people love it.
My go-to Mexican dish that I really like, seems kind of simple, is a good chimichanga.
Hey, you can't go wrong with that. That's, you know, chimichanga's a deep-fried burrito, basically. Can't go wrong with that.
What's your favorite, Rick?
Oh, I like a molcajete, which is kind of similar to fajitas. They serve it in a large volcanic rock that's heated up on, like, face down, on a stove, and it's heated up to where it could power a sauna. I mean, this thing is hot. And you put the ingredients in it, maybe a little queso, maybe a little salsa, you know, just something to spice it up a little bit. And it's served like sizzling, piping hot. It just smells delicious. You order this thing, and it could feed 3 or 4 people because, of course, you get a large dish of rice and beans as well and a lot of tortillas, and it's quite good. I like mine with steak, chicken, and shrimp. You can get different varieties at different restaurants. But, yeah, molcajete is quite good. I like sopes, too, which are kind of like fried masa discs, and they layer a bunch of stuff, chicken, beef, whatever, with lettuce, tomatoes, yada, yada. They're about 4 or 5 inches high. And I really enjoy sopes and also taquitos / flautas. And there's kind of an argument about what those are. But I just eat them. They're really good. If they're deep fried and crispy, I'll eat them.
I would say that some Mexican restaurants are more modern and some are maybe a little more old school. Give us an idea of some of the old school Mexican restaurants that are around.
Well, in Fargo here, and actually around the state of North Dakota, there's a Mexican Village, and Paradiso is one you'll find quite often. And people they've lasted, obviously, for a reason. The Mexican Village on Main Avenue in Fargo closed not too long ago, but I think people are looking for something a little more authentic, perhaps a little more spicy, something that has a little more flavor. Those restaurants were geared Tex-Mex towards the palate here for quite a long time. But with the abundance of Mexican restaurants in the whole area, I think people are looking for a more authentic experience. And this is no slight to Mexican Village or Paradiso. They've lasted. They've had a lot of good employees. Obviously, they've done quite well. But I think it's just kind of taking a turn for an improvement these days. Let's just say that.
The first restaurant that my wife and I in downtown Fargo, after we moved here just now about 2 years ago, was Vinyl Taco.
And oh, yeah.
We've been back. We like it a lot.
It's delicious. They do a really good job over there. That crew does a really good job over there. Vinyl Taco is great, yes.
You have written about this recently, Rick, in your High Plains Reader food column. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I went over a lot of, just touched on a lot of points we talked about here and a few more. For the High Plains Reader, I write a monthly food column. You can go to hpr1.com and check it out. I kind of went a little more in depth and also talked about some of the Mexican restaurants in the Minnesota Lakes area, the small town of Pelican Rapids. I think it's about 2,500 people or so these days, has three taquerias itself, which is kind of astounding. And that kind of goes with the population and the workforce there. But they have a lot of good Mexican food in Pelican Rapids, Fergus Falls, Detroit Lakes, all around the lakes area. And it's great to see. I mean, I'm not complaining about this. I'm definitely probably gaining a little bit of weight because of it. But it's really been fun to see.
When we would drive to school, Rick, I went to the school at the University of Wyoming. I lived in central Wyoming, and we'd always drive on I-80 past a little town called Sinclair, known for its oil refinery, right? Big dino, green dino thing. They make gasoline there. Off the beaten path, there was our favorite, by far, Mexican cafe in Wyoming called Su Casa Cafe.
Hmm.
You're looking at a picture of it. It looks nondescript. It's right in a neighborhood. This town is about, I don't know, a couple hundred is all. You can't get in, number one, unless you know when to go. And number two, it is so good.
That parking lot looks packed, probably for good reason.
Yeah. That brings back some really, really good memories because we would just be either done with school and heading home or getting ready to go to school and stopping in. But yeah, that was pretty much a must stop for us there, for better or for worse.
And it looked like there was a photo of some sopapillas on the side there, which is
very
kind
good
of a
sopapillas
Mexican,
there.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
little dessert. Yeah.
Yum.
Yeah. We had our share of those for sure. Any other Mexican restaurants around the state that come to your mind, Rick, that you want to pop off here?
Well, in Fargo here, I really like Plaza Azteca quite a bit. I've been going over to Guadalajara quite a bit because Mango's on Main Avenue closed due to a fire about a month ago, which was really unfortunate, about $500,000 in damage. And it's probably going to be a while before they open again because insurance checks and hoods for ovens and stoves take a while to appear. So Guadalajara, same menu basically as Mango's. So if you're looking for a replacement for Mango's, everyone loved Mango's because mm-hmm. the prices were good, the speed of the service, and the food was just good. So, and then I really liked Taqueria Chavez in Pelican Rapids.
I've heard about it, haven't stopped.
It's quite good. All three of them are quite good in Pelican Rapids, but this one I do really enjoy, so check it out if you haven't already.
Rewind just a little bit. I need to give readers the website they can read your High Plains Reader food column at, and that's at hpr1.com. You can hover over the Eat and Drink tab, and you can read about Rick Guillon's recommendations for Mexican food. Rick, people can also find you on Facebook, right?
Yeah, Fargo Moorhead Eats. It's a big group. We just hit 40,000 followers. So, and also, if you have Mexican food recommendations like in Bismarck or Grand Forks or around the state, email plates@prairiepublic.org.
Rick Guillon joins us each and every Wednesday here on Main Street for Prairie Plates. Rick, thanks for stopping by.
You bet, Craig.
The Bush Foundation will be accepting applications for the 2025 Bush Fellowship from September 17th through October 15th. The fellowship is an investment in the people leading change in our region so they can create bigger change in their communities. 30 fellows will be selected and receive $150,000 to grow their capacity, knowledge, and networks to lead. Learn more about how to apply for the Bush Fellowship at bushfoundation.org.
The oldest continually run black rodeo in the United States takes place each year in Okmulgee, Oklahoma. The Roy LeBlanc Okmulgee Invitational Rodeo draws competitors from across the country. This year, hundreds of attendees watched events such as the Mutton Busting Competition, where kids ride sheep, the Pony Express, a relay race on horseback, and Ladies Steer Undecorating, where horseback riders tear tape or ribbon off a steer. Harvest Public Media's Anna Pope was at the Invitational and brought back this audio postcard.
So we're going to bring in the Dakota Rough Rider. Rodeo fans are going to kick off 69 years of Okmulgee Roy LeBlanc Invitational Rodeo.
My name is Kenneth LeBlanc, and I am the coordinator for the Okmulgee Roy LeBlanc Invitational Rodeo. My dad and my grandfather and about 22 other guys, they started the Okmulgee County Roundup Club in 1956. And the reason why they started it is because they used to have a white rodeo here, and my dad was a calf roper, and he was made to participate after rodeo. And then where they had the rodeo at, they had a section sectioned off, and it said colored section, and that's where they want the black people to sit, you know. And my grandfather, he kind of got offended by that because he felt like he should be able to sit down where and watch the rodeo wherever he wanted to. And after that, that's when they got together and formed the Okmulgee County Roundup Club. Everything is special about this rodeo to me because my brother's involved in it and all my family's involved in it.
Well, we got the next cowboy right here is Carter Henderson. He said, I'm 8. He got one that's going to go. You better hold on, Carter.
Carter Henderson, I was in a mud-busting rodeo. This is my first time, really.
Come on, Muggy, hold him out.
Well, he's off. He's safe.
I told my daddy at the Black Rodeo in Texarkana, please let me do mud-busting. They couldn't sign me up. So I did this one. My daddy said, let's do it in Foreman. I said, no, I want to go to the big main event. I like when you say celebrate stuff.
All right, guys, can you hear me out there? You know what time it is, right? It's Pony Express time here at the 69th Annual.
Man, we've been doing this event probably 10 plus years. I'm Aaron Foster. The name of our team is the A-State Regulators out of Arkansas, and we compete in the Pony Express. Now, we didn't kind of grow up doing it, but we just picked it up along the way. We always been cowboys. It's competitive. It's, you know, all or nothing. When you hit that dirt, it's a different feeling, you know. So we love it. The Okmulgee Rodeo, this is it. This is what we practice for all year. This the big one right here. The most important part is there are black cowboys, and we do this. You know, we do this too. We was the first cowboys, so I mean, it's competing out there is just it's something about it. It's like history.
Hi, my name is Cheyenne Williams. I'm 19 years old from Houston, Texas, and I'll be competing in the Ladies Stand Decorating. The Ladies Stand Decorating is a tape on the steer. We have the stand decorator, and then on the right side, we have the hazer. The Ladies Stand Decorating, we ride on side of the steer and get the tape and raise it in the air. Well, I've been rodeoing all my life. It's in my bloodline. My mother, she also does Ladies Stand Decorating, and she runs barrels also. My dad, he's a calf roper. My grandpa, he was a steer wrestler, a bronc rider, a bull rider, a calf roper. And my brothers, they rope calves. I love the history of the event. This rodeo is special because it's been going on for years, and it gets bigger and bigger every year.
Thank you for coming to the parade, as well as two nights at the rodeo.
This audio postcard was produced by Harvest Public Media's Anna Pope. Harvest Public Media is a collection of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains based at KCUR.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the recipients of the 2024 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2024 Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
And now, another episode of Poetry from Studio 47 which comes to us from Patrick Hicks, writer in residence and a member of the English faculty at Augustana University in Sioux Falls.
This is Poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is William Wordsworth. He was born on April 7th, 1770, in Cumberland, England. He was the second of five kids and grew up in an idyllic part of the country known as the Lake District. This would have a profound effect on him and, by extension, English literature. His father was away on business often, and this meant young William didn't know him very well. When Wordsworth's mother died in 1778, his father sent him away to Hawkshead Grammar School. Wordsworth didn't see much of his siblings after this and committed himself to schooling. When he graduated from Hawkshead, he was accepted into St. John's College at the University of Cambridge. He received his BA in 1791. Immediately after graduation, he went to revolutionary France, where he admired those who challenged the king. While there, he fell in love with Annette Vallon. They had a daughter in 1792. Wordsworth, however, was forced to return to England due to the worsening relationship between Britain and France. As the revolution turned more bloody, and as the guillotine claimed ever more lives, Wordsworth turned away from his early admiration. It also meant he couldn't return to France. When things finally quieted down, Wordsworth did return in 1802. By then, his daughter was 10 and estranged from him. He offered financial help for the rest of his life, but the relationship was over between he and Annette Vallon. He later remarried an English woman named Mary Hutchinson and would be with her until his death. Wordsworth became good friends with fellow poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Between them, they would create a new movement in English literature called Romanticism. Importantly, the Romantics were not interested in love or romance. They were interested in how England and the British Empire was similar to the Romans, hence the Romantics. They also cared about the countryside, and their poems often dealt with nature. This is hardly surprising when we consider that the Industrial Revolution was happening, and places like the Lake District were under threat of pollution. Wordsworth and Coleridge would write poems in everyday language, poems that could be understood by almost anyone, and they wrote for a wide audience. His books include Lyrical Ballads, Poems in Two Volumes, The Excursion, and The Prelude. Wordsworth became a celebrated poet throughout the United Kingdom, and, in fact, he became the Poet Laureate in 1843. As he aged, however, he wrote less and less. This became even more true when one of his daughters died quite suddenly and he fell into depression. His work, especially his early work, transformed English literature due to not only its subject matter and the voice he employed, but also for its sheer readability. He died on April 23, 1850, in Grasmere. Today's poem is Composed Upon Westminster Bridge, September 3, 1802. My favorite city is, without question, London. There's something about the pulse of the place, the history, the buildings, the parks, the energy of the streets. It all captivates me. I miss it when I'm not there. In fact, if someone told me to choose a city I could never leave, I'd choose London every time. I am, quite simply, in love with the place, and whenever I return, it's like going home. I think many writers feel this way, and if you're British, it's virtually impossible not to be influenced by London. The same is true for you, too, of course. I mean, after all, the words coming out of my mouth are in English. These are the words of a faraway city, a city that was once the capital of a global empire. Although we don't think about it this way, it's true that London was once the capital of our country. This is why we rebelled, of course, in 1776. Colonial America no longer wanted London to be our capital. So, for good or bad, this English city has directly influenced world history for many centuries. I've written about all of this in one of my books called This London. As for Wordsworth, although his first love was the Lake District in northern England, and although much of his poetry deals with nature, his fortunes were tied to the metropolis of London. For those in the 1800s, London was sometimes called the Big Smoke due to all of the pollution. I mean, just imagine all the coal smoke that filled the air at the time. That euphemism, London fog, is something that you might have heard about. But that fog? That's not fog. That's banks of coal smoke that people had to walk through. For Wordsworth, a man who loved hikes and nature, he must have found the pollution of London to be an ordeal. Which brings us to our poem for the day. Here, Wordsworth is on Westminster Bridge. That's the one immediately in front of Big Ben. I'm sure you've seen it. And he's looking out at the city. It's dawn, everything is quiet, and the mighty engine of this empire city is still. But he knows that London will soon awaken, and he marvels at the sleeping energy which will soon rise. This is Composed Upon Westminster Bridge, September 3rd, 1802, by William Wordsworth. Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty. This city now doth, like a garment, wear the beauty of the morning, silent, bare, ships, towers, domes, theaters, and temples lie open unto the fields and to the sky, all bright and glittering in the smokeless air. Never did sun more beautifully steep in his first splendor valley, rock, or hill. Ne'er saw I, never felt, a calm so deep. The river glideth at his own sweet will. Dear God, the very houses seem asleep, and all that mighty heart is lying still.
Patrick Hicks reading Composed Upon Westminster Bridge, September 3rd, 1802, by William Wordsworth. Poetry from Studio 47 is recorded at Augustana University and is produced by Peter Folliard.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 28th. In 1912, political fervor and interest swept the country over the presidential election. President Taft sought the Republican nomination, challenged by former President Theodore Roosevelt, who unexpectedly entered the race. Senator Robert La Follette was yet another contender for the nomination. When North Dakota held its primary that March, La Follette was the winner even over Roosevelt, who was so popular in the state. Various newspapers claimed that Democrats had voted for La Follette, affecting the results. And those with La Follette claimed that reactionaries and stand-patters alone voted for Roosevelt. Nonetheless, La Follette's popularity fell off, and as the Republican Party looked to back Taft, Roosevelt still sought the presidency under a third party, the National Progressive Party. It was becoming well known as the Bull Moose Party after he described himself as fit as a bull moose. There were men in North Dakota who supported Roosevelt. Dorr H. Carroll, who owned a farm near Carpio, was also an attorney, ex-newspaper man, real estate dealer, and merchant, and was very involved in progressive politics. He had backed La Follette, but now threw himself behind Roosevelt. By early August, a brief note in the Bismarck Tribune stated he was in full charge of the state's progressive campaign. What there is of it. There were men in North Dakota who supported Roosevelt. With all the back and forth, it may have seemed especially ominous when, on this date, some valuable documents of the Bull Moose Party were stolen from Dorr Carroll as he traveled on a Great Northern passenger train. A search ensued for a thief, but the manhunt ending was rather tame. It was just a case of mistaken baggage. Another man had taken Mr. Carroll's suitcase instead of his own. Noticing the mistake, the man immediately notified Carroll and the bag. Its valuable contents were returned. By the way, the 1912 election ended with North Dakota voting for Democrat Woodrow Wilson. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Sarah Walker. I'm Ann Olquist.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow, our resident movie critic Matt Olean will share his thoughts on Blink Twice. And we'll revisit our timely interview with NDSU Extension agent Don Kinsler, packed with expert advice on preparing your lawn and garden for the fall and winter seasons. That's all coming up tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.